woman. And you've bitten me, heavens why? You know your bite is poisonous, and now I'm going to die. Oh, shut up, silly woman, said the reptile with a grin. You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in.
President Trump at the conservative CPAC conference last week, reading the lyrics of a song called The Snake. Trump presents the story as an allegory about immigration. It's been popular at his campaign speeches and rallies. We're going to find out where it comes from in a moment. But first, Trump received a setback from the Supreme Court today. The court decided to stay out of the dispute around DACA. For now. And that means the Trump administration may not be able to end the program next Monday as planned. It also means there's less pressure on Congress now to immediately pass a new bill to replace DACA. Dara Lind is an immigration reporter for Vox, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, first, remind us what the Trump administration had asked the Supreme Court to consider.
Sure. So in January, a federal judge in California issued an order that the Trump administration had to start accepting applications from immigrants who had been covered by the DACA program for two-year renewals of their work permits. The Trump administration had stopped accepting those in the fall. The Trump administration wanted to not have to do that, and furthermore wanted to stop doing it quickly. So they asked the Supreme Court to let them skip the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is normally what they would go to next, and just take the case straight up to the Supreme Court, essentially skipping from level one to level three of the judicial system.
So the court basically said, we're not going to do
that. You can't do that.
Okay.
Right, exactly. They said you have to follow the standard we have in place that everybody else goes through.
Okay, but it doesn't mean that they won't decide on this issue down the road sometime.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, they kind of strongly implied that they would. They said they made it clear that they weren't casting any aspersions on the case itself and said that they hoped that the Ninth Circuit would act pretty rapidly. So it does look like they are planning to take this up, but given the timing in the court's term, it's unlikely that they're going to be able to get to it before their next term starts in October. So essentially, especially given that the Ninth Circuit is pretty liberal, as is the Second Circuit, where a judge made a similar ruling in New York, it's not looking like the Trump administration is going to get the ruling it wants for several more months.
And we've all been focusing on March 5th, so next week, as the deadline, and that a lot of people would lose their work permits on that day. So what does this mean for them?
So honestly, the March 5th deadline has always been a little bit overstated in terms of what it actually means for DACA recipients. Because DACA is based on the individual work permits that immigrants have, the expiration date on those individual work permits is what matters. March 5th, because it marked the first date that someone who had a work permit that expired then couldn't apply for a renewal, was going to be kind of an inflection point. Estimates indicate that anywhere from 400 to 1,000 DACA recipients could have work permits that expired that day and the next day, et cetera. Because of the January ruling, some of those people have already been able to apply for a two-year renewal. And just in the last few days, a couple of lawyers have started reporting that those renewed work permits have started coming back. So the Supreme Court's ruling means that this process is going to stay open for several more months, probably, and it's just going to continue to slow down what's already been this very slow rollback of the DACA program.
Okay, so people will be able to renew their work permits for 2 years, only once, though, right?
You can only get one extension at a time, but this is essentially in place until the courts figure out whether the Trump administration acted correctly in the way it shut down the program to begin with. It's not likely that they're going to say that it couldn't do anything to end DACA at all, but in a scenario where the Supreme Court, say, says that the Trump administration didn't follow a specific regulatory process and needs to do that, it could take them several more months to a year. That's going to be substantially down the road, though. It's several months out at least.
Okay. And then, so you can keep renewing it, let's say, if it after 2 years they still haven't come to a definitive decision.
Yeah, it does. As long as federal court stuff takes, it's probably not going to be that long. I think that the Supreme Court has shown a willingness to act a little bit faster than usual in really politically sensitive cases, and the Ninth Circuit has already promised to take this up in an expedited fashion. So we're probably going to be looking at a resolution in a matter of months rather than years. It's just that because everyone's attention has been on this March 5th date, the fact that the policy consequences of that were already not as huge as people thought and are now going to be, you know, spread out along an even longer period of time means that the, you know, fate of DACA is going to be a little more under the radar probably than people thought.
Okay, that's the court side. What does this do for Congress then?
Congress hasn't shown a lot of willingness to act even when they were under the gun and everybody thought that this March 5th deadline was a huge deal. So if anything, the continued court battling just gives Congress more excuses not to act. They haven't seen a lot of interest in actually getting together and figuring out something that would protect DACA recipients. It's gotten tied up in this much bigger debate about enforcement trade-offs and legal immigration, and the less impetus there is, the less risk that a Republican legislator is going to be confronted with someone who, in his district, who's lost a work permit or who has been arrested by ICE, the less interest there is likely to be in making some compromises to get something done.
Well, have there been DACA recipients who have been arrested?
In a couple of cases, yes. Because DACA recipients are already, who missed the renewal deadline in the fall, have already started losing status, there have been a couple of cases of those immigrants getting arrested, pulled over, turned over to ICE. Because there haven't been a lot of people losing DACA yet, we don't know how widespread that is, and there is not evidence that ICE is targeting people after losing DACA and tracking them down. But the federal government's position is that if you're an unauthorized immigrant in the U.S., no matter what, you know, whether you had a work permit last week or have never had a work permit, if they come across you, they can't arrest and deport you.
Why doesn't Congress, since this is a very popular program on both sides of the aisle, why don't they just have a clean DACA bill and vote on that and not complicate it with all this other more controversial immigration legislation?
So while DACA itself is popular, both parties have different ideas about what that means, right? For Democrats, that does mean they should just pass a clean Dream Act. For Republicans, that means that this is a good opportunity for them to address other things in the immigration system that they've wanted to address, such as increased border security, such as for some Republicans restricting legal immigration, because from that point of view, because everyone wants to get a fix on DACA, the other side should be willing to make some concessions just to make sure that there are assurances of protection for the people who would be affected.
All right. Dara Lind, immigration reporter for Vox. Thanks for the update.
Thank you.
Take me in, tender wound. Take me in, for heaven's sake. Take me in, tender woman. Side the snake.
That's a song called The Snake by Oscar Brown Jr. It came out back in 1963. President Trump read the lyrics to that song at a number of campaign stops and rallies when he was running for office, and he brought it back at the conservative CPAC conference last week. In the president's hands, the song has become an allegory about the dangers of letting immigrants into the country.
She stroked his pretty skin again and kissed and held him tight. But instead of saying thank you, that snake gave her a vicious bite.
Well, here to talk about that, we have Eli Rosenberg. He reports for the Washington Post. He's looked into the background of that song and why President Trump uses it. Hi.
How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, first of all, tell us a little more about Oscar Brown Jr. and why he wrote that song and what it's about in his mind.
Yeah, Oscar Brown Jr. Most simply described as a jazz singer from Chicago. He sort of defies easy categorization. He was a songwriter, a musician, a performer, an entertainer, you know, performed in nightclubs for years, wrote many songs to sort of put lyrics to some very famous jazz songs like, you know, Nat Adderley's Work Song. And he was also, in addition to sort of his work as a musician, he was a bit of an activist. He was very engaged in the community. He saw his work as an artist as sort of something more than just performing. He was a member of the Communist Party, but described himself, after he left, as too black to be red. And, you know, his work, he worked with gang members and teens and doing stage shows in Chicago. So very sort of hard to pin down with just one label, but a musician and activist and performer from Chicago who was big in the 1950s and 60s.
So not a conservative, not someone who would be at CPAC.
Look, I mean, I think it's safe to say no. His family certainly says no. He was, you know, sort of describing himself as further left than the Communist Party in the 1950s. So, yeah, I think that's safe to say.
Okay, well, let's hear a clip from his daughters, Maggie and Africa. They were on MSNBC yesterday.
First of all, he's stealing. Oscar Brown Jr. wrote those lyrics.
And Oscar Brown Jr. wrote
the snake. And he's stealing, and then he's twisting Oscar's meaning to serve his own campaign and climate of intolerance and hate, which is the opposite of what the original author, Oscar Brown Jr., intended.
All right, so how did this song wind up as a staple for Donald Trump at rallies?
Well, it's a really kind of interesting journey that this song is taken from, you know, being written by Oscar Brown Jr. in the 1960s to ending up as this sort of kind of greatest hit anti-immigrant poem that Trump likes to break out at rallies. It's not totally clear how it made the jump. It looks like before it was in Trump's hands, it was sort of circulating in conservative media. If you look at some sort of fringy blogs from 2015, kind of pops up in the comment section in regards to sort of the similar kind of anti-immigrant sentiment that Trump uses it as. And Trump himself sort of said, you know, well, this sort of came to us. His campaign manager has said the same thing. Oh, I think someone sent it in at some point. So it doesn't look like Trump was the one who sort of gave it that meaning, but he certainly amplified it and made it what it is today for him.
And people really respond to it, right?
You know, it's sort of, like I said, like a bit of, for his fans, like a greatest hit. I mean, he said at CPAC, you know, all these, I think five people, he said, had asked him beforehand whether he was going to do the snake. And I guess he got a standing ovation at CPAC as well. So for his fans, this is something that they really enjoy and strikes a chord with them.
And does he leave it open to interpretation, or does he say exactly what he means by it?
Well, I think that's what's interesting is that, you know, Oscar Brown Jr., if you talk to his daughters, you know, he left it as an allegory, right? Sort of open to whatever meaning you want to put on it. For Trump, I think it's a little bit different. It's clearly a sort of fable about the perils of immigration. He will often sort of preface it by talking about the dangers of refugees or immigrants or the wrong people coming into our country. At CPAC, he spoke about MS-13, the gang. So it's pretty explicitly meant to illustrate something about immigration and what we need to do that we're not doing in this country.
And does he credit Oscar Brown Jr. when he reads it?
It doesn't look like he's actually credited Oscar Brown Jr. You know, you play that clip from Maggie and I believe Africa Brown, his daughters. They're upset about the fact that they think the song has been sort of appropriated in the service of what they believe to be prejudice. But sort of adding insult to injury for them is the fact that they are upset that the president has never credited them. He's given a couple of times Al Wilson, another singer who sort of popularized the song but didn't write it. He's given Al Wilson credit before, but not Oscar Brown Jr.
So if his daughters are unhappy, obviously, that Trump is using the song, but is there anything they can do about it?
You know, I think they're doing what they can do. They've spoken out on it. They've given interviews. They're happy to talk about it. I don't know if there's, you know, this is not, I don't believe to be the same case as, you know, a sort of piece of music that might be played before a campaign rally where there's sort of more copyright restrictions involved. But in this case, Trump is just reading the lyrics from a piece of paper typically. And I don't think, you know, I think that's his right for better or worse.
All right. Eli Rosenberg, reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, why the Supreme Court is expected to issue a ruling that could substantially weaken unions and, with it, the Democratic Party. That's next on Press Play.
Yeah.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. All right, so a busy day at the Supreme Court today. The court also heard another big case dealing with labor unions. At issue is whether government employees have to pay collective bargaining fees, even if they're not members of the union. But even though the justice's decision won't come out for months, we can all but guarantee the outcome. The ruling is likely to gut the power of public unions here in California and in other states. It is Monday, which means Jessica Levinson is here to talk about this with us. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular legal eagle. Hello.
Hello.
Okay. Why is this case all but decided?
This case is all but decided because virtually the same legal question came to the court a few years ago, and the court actually deadlocked because when the court made its decision, Justice Antonin Scalia had already passed away and the court only had 8 members. So we basically know that the liberal wing of the court is going to say, we can uphold this law. We can uphold state laws that allow unions to say we need to get agency fees from non-members. And we know that the conservative wing of the court says, no, you can't. That infringes on First Amendment rights. So the only person who hasn't actually weighed in on this decision is the newest Supreme Court Justice, Neil Gorsuch. And I think every indication is that he will vote with the conservative side of the conservative wing of the Supreme Court and that these agency fees will be a thing of the past.
Okay. They're called fees and not dues because these are not union members who are objecting to paying them, right?
That's exactly right. So what we're talking about are people who are public sector employees, and they've decided not to join the public sector union, but they are still required to pay something called agency fees. And the idea is that this prevents them from being so-called free riders. The idea is that they are actually benefited from the union representation, even if they're not members of the union, specifically that they benefit from the union's collective bargaining. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that they should at least be forced to pay for that collective bargaining. It's important to note that they cannot be forced to pay for the union's political activities, that in 1977, the Supreme Court actually reviewed this issue and said, it's okay to ask people who are not members of unions to pay these agency fees to cover the costs of collective bargaining, but it's not okay to force them to pay for the union's political activity, because that's forced political speech, and that's not okay under the First Amendment.
And yet, as you said earlier, the plaintiff in this case is arguing on a free speech basis. So what is the argument?
So that's exactly right. So the argument is, you know, that decision that you made in 1977, court, you were actually wrong for these reasons. And the reasons are basically that, one, you can't uncouple or you can't unlink collective bargaining when it comes to public sector unions from political activity, and that it's too hard to separate those two. And relatedly, that collective bargaining when it comes to public sector unions actually is inherently political. So what the challenger here is saying is, when you force me to pay those agency fees that cover collective bargaining, you're basically forcing me to pay for lobbying. And lobbying is clearly political. So you are therefore forcing me to engage in political speech and see the First Amendment. You can't do that under the First Amendment. And I absolutely think there's 5 votes that says, yes, challenger, you are right. This is a First Amendment violation.
And why isn't it political? Because when you look at the power that unions have, a lot of them are, you know, most of them are democratically inclined, and they are a big source of money for the Democratic Party.
Well, and that's what this case really is largely boiled down to, because there are the legal questions. There are these questions about the First Amendment, whether you can force non-union members to pay these agency fees, and what exactly the First Amendment protects and prevents against. But what we're really talking about here is, are we going to significantly hobble unions? And meaning, are we going to significantly harm Democrats? Because we know that unions support Democrats, and if the court decides that states cannot require people to pay these agency fees, what that means is unions will have a lot less money and they'll probably have fewer members, because there are people now who are kind of on the fence about whether they should join a union. And because they have to pay agency fees or union dues, some of them say, well, you know what, I'm just going to join the union. If you no longer are forced to pay agency fees, then you will see more people opting out of joining the union. So unions would lose people and money, the two things that give any entity power.
But then on the other side, if the unions went away, wouldn't the workers then say, oh, wait a minute, I'm not being paid as much, I'm not getting the health and benefits and the retirement benefits that I thought I was going to get. Unions, can you come back in? And yeah, we'll pay the dues and the fees.
Well, there's always that possibility that there's a bunch of workers who say, you know what, actually, the unions did represent me well, and they did, in their collective bargaining, get a lot of helpful things for me, like, you know, sick leave and workplace protection. And there's a lot that's important there. So we need to go back to the union. It's, practically speaking, it's always harder to rebuild a union at that point, though. So I think that at the very least, we would see a number of years of significantly weakened unions.
So speaking of politics, on the other side, it appears that some, you know, deep pockets, big money Republican donors have been bankrolling these efforts to really undermine public sector unions, including backing the plaintiff in this particular case, Mark Janus.
Well, that's exactly right. And what we're seeing here is basically a two-pronged approach, where Republicans very rightly recognize that in the zero-sum game of politics, they will benefit if unions are significantly harmed because unions help Democrats. And so very much like a case that we've been talking about for a long time, the Citizens United case, Republicans have looked at a specific state laws or federal laws, and they've said, you know what, these laws are harming us. So instead of just waging a political attack and trying to get lawmakers to repeal these laws, we're going to wage a legal attack. And so this case brings up these very important political issues about the power of unions. And clearly, Republicans are very correctly making the calculus that they should spend money to try and get these laws overturned, because they will enormously benefit from that. And we're seeing these court cases that are in large part funded by conservative or in some cases liberal causes, because they know that they will benefit by these court decisions.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, what the other half thinks about gun control. We'll go to rural Tulare County to see what conservatives think should happen in the wake of the Florida school shooting. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The shooting in Parkland, Florida, reigniting the national debate on gun rights. And there is a clear cultural divide between majority rural states, such as Kentucky, and urban ones, such as New York. California has some of the most comprehensive gun control measures in the country. But there are significant parts of California that where there are supporters of the NRA, and they are in the majority. Tulare County is one of them. It's the area north of Bakersfield that stretches from Visalia to Sequoia National Park. With a population of about 500,000, it is represented by Republican Congressman Devin Nunes. Paul Myers covers the county for the local newspaper, The Sun Gazette. He joins us now. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Well, how are people in your area talking about what happened in Parkland, Florida?
You know, I think that the most people that I speak with, everybody has this collective feeling that, you know, that was a tragedy and it's terrible. But as soon as you start shifting the conversation to what should be done about future instances like that in terms of gun control, the culture and their kind of ideals change with it as well. You know, they are very much in favor of they want to keep their guns. It's very much cultural, tribal kind of feeling in the area.
And are they saying, well, this is more about mental health? And
yeah, that's pretty much how they characterize it most times. Yeah,
right. And what about their kids in schools? Are they worried about their safety?
You know, it's funny that you say that. We're actually working on a story this week on kind of a trend article of school shooting threats. And in where we're located here in Exeter, Tulare County, there was a threat on Friday, and I guess it had grown over the week over social media between students. And Friday it came to a head during an assembly, and there were parents that were coming up in waves to the school office asking for their kids and clamoring to get their kids out of class. And I guess it even got to a point where parents went into the assembly, they started plucking their children out of the assembly and going home. And then even after lunch, kids, because it's an open campus, kids can go off campus for lunch. And I guess half didn't even come back. They were so worried.
Wow. Well, so we saw last week that there was some shifting in terms of the Republican stance on gun rights. You know, there's some support now for raising the age limit and for banning bump stocks, for example. Are you seeing any shifting at all when it comes to gun rights support in your area?
Not so much. I think that most people around here, they kind of understand that California gun laws are pretty, for lack of a better term, fairly liberal. And so for them, they're probably a little bit more accustomed to more restrictions than the average United States citizen and in other areas of the country. So as far as they're concerned, it's for them, they kind of see this as California's already regulating it to a point that they see unfair, so the national conversation doesn't really resonate with them much.
So they think it's unfair what has happened here in terms of gun restrictions.
In California?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not uncommon for some people who are, gun folks to call it commie-fornia whenever it comes down to gun laws in the state.
So they think that the urban parts of California are dictating gun policy that people who live here in L.A., for example, they don't really understand because they don't, you know, they're not in a rural area.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's kind of a feeling that you don't only get with gun control issues and issues like that, but also very much political issues in California.
Let me play a clip of tape from Devin Nunes, who represents Tulare.
Mm-hmm. I always worry about people thinking that like more gun control somehow is going to solve this problem. Mm-hmm. I don't see that. Now, look, do I believe in bump stocks? No, but I didn't even know what that was until the Vegas shooting. So, you know, if there's ways to make sure that we're enforcing the laws on the books, that's helpful. If there are ways to improve background checks, that's helpful. But I don't think nothing takes the place of when someone is turned into law enforcement and it's not dealt with promptly and swiftly, that there's nothing replaces that. Mm-hmm. Somebody who, because remember, even if you institute gun control, mm-hmm. the guys who want guns are going to be able to get guns.
Okay, Devin Nunes there, and he has been in the news for other reasons as chairman of the House Intelligence Committee.
That's
and
right.
Writing that famous Russia memo. So does he still have broad support in Tulare County, and by extension, does President Trump?
Yes to both. I would say that whenever it comes to the issue of gun control, people really don't look to Devin Nunes so much for leadership on that at all. They are concerned with water here, and kind of more conservative environmental policy is really where they look for Devin Nunes. As far as President Trump is concerned, Tulare County is very much a supporter of President Trump, and I think that's more so like on a I guess you could consider a political and almost spiritual level in a way. They kind of, you know, believe in most things that he says wholesale. They don't really, they're not so concerned in challenging what the remarks that he makes or anything such as that. They just kind of feel that it resonates with them, not so much factually, but just kind of the way that they feel about the general state of politics in the country.
Mm. There was a writer in the Washington Post recently named Terry Carter who wrote from Kentucky. She lives in Kentucky, and she was saying how people there are pretty much single-issue voters. They vote on guns and abortion, and everything mm-hmm. else is secondary.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned water, but aside from that, is that generally the case in Tulare?
Very much so. It's kind of a, if it doesn't really affect me, then it's an, and it's not really in my sphere of influence, then it's not really an issue that people care about.
And what about the immigration issue? Because there are obviously a lot of people working on the farms there from Mexico and other countries south of the border.
Yeah, so from the folks that I speak with a lot of times, they're concerned more so over labor and how immigration affects labor in this particular part of California. You know, whenever it comes down to DACA, there's much less of a discussion as if it doesn't involve some sort of like labor force and farm working force, as it affects them here, is kind of where the conversation begins to evolve.
But is there a sense that there needs to be immigration reform, some way of fixing the immigration problem?
You know, not so much. I'll be honest. They have an opinion, but as far as having it be strong enough to say that we need to do this or we need to do that, they're more so concerned with, well, then how do we get labor into this area of the country? That's kind of where they stand on those issues more times than not.
Okay, so when you look at all of this and you look at how these debates, immigration, gun control, et cetera, are being covered nationally, do you see a big disconnect between what the national conversation is and the voters in Tulare County?
I wouldn't necessarily call it a disconnect. I think that if you ask these folks for their opinion, they definitely have one. And I think that, you know, the answers that you would get from folks around here is probably representative of what you would get from conservative-minded points of view in the national level, as far as the Second Amendment is for protecting yourself against the government and self-protection. And they kind of feel that encapsulates who they are. It's definitely the national conversation definitely resonates with them very well in that way.
Mm. So it's more of a cultural ideological approach.
Yeah, Paul, I would agree.
Paul Myers, editor of the Sun Gazette, which covers Tulare County. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, mountain climber David Roberts on why he climbed dangerous peaks.
Your skill is all devoted to not overcoming fear. You can't do that, but to figuring a way out of the trap that fear presents.
The meaning of adventure, why people do it, and whether it's all worth it, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. David Roberts is one of the best mountain climbers of his generation. He's been described also as the Dean of Adventure Writing. He's written more than 24 books on mountain climbing. He's mentored John Krakauer and co-wrote free climber Alex Honnold's memoir, Alone on the Wall. One of the defining climbs of his career was back in 1965. He and three companions climbed the west face of Mount Huntington in Alaska. It took them 32 days to go up, but on the way down, one of his partners fell 4,000 feet and died. 50 years later, David Roberts and another original member of that journey went back to Alaska to celebrate the anniversary of that climb. And on that trip, though, he noticed a lump in his throat. He was diagnosed later with stage 4 throat cancer. Now David Roberts is out with a new book, a memoir, really, that looks at mortality and our relationship to extreme risk. It's called Limits of the Known. And David Roberts joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So your cancer, really bad diagnosis there, stage 4, and you describe it as metastasizing after the initial treatment. And I guess I'm just wondering how your confrontation with your own mortality has changed your idea, your concept of risk and of adventure.
I think what the cancer did was to sharpen my curiosity about why I'd spent my whole adult life pursuing adventure and whether it had any meaning beyond just the pleasure I got from it at the time. I mean, I've been thinking about that all my life and writing about it, but never with this sort of sense of doom hanging over me. Mm. And I didn't want to make it just about myself. I thought that it was important to answer the question that so few adventurers do answer well, which is why they do what they do and what good does it do anybody else?
What do other people say? What are other climbers' answers to that?
Climbers and adventurers generally have been terribly inarticulate and sort of simplistic about the question. And I was guilty of this for many years. They tend to view the whole business of adventure as an equation measuring risk against reward. And what I realized after decades was that that didn't take into account all the other people who might be affected by something like Ed Burns' fatal accident on Huntington, and that you couldn't simply weigh the joys versus the sorrows and come up with a rationale for adventure. You had to figure out whether it was worth it in terms of the pain it might inflict upon your loved ones.
So you describe going out on your adventures and your wife always saying to you, giving you a kiss and saying, be careful, right? And that kind of rankled you, that she would worry about you when you were climbing?
Rankled is not quite the right word. It infected me with my own doubts. It made me think, well, gosh, if Sharon's worrying about me, then I have to worry about her worrying about me. But now I'm incredibly grateful for that because her love and care have actually kept me alive in this medical crisis.
Yeah. So when you look back on your climbs and your 50 years plus of climbing, what is the answer as to why you did it?
I think if I had to reduce it to one measure of the value of it is that adventure is really about discovery and exploration. And we live in a world in which it's all too easy to think that we know everything, that we've explored every square mile of the globe, that every place is mapped. But I truly believe that there are many adventures for the taking today that still are pushing ultimate frontiers, and that my own adventuring at its best was a pursuit of the unknown, and whence the title, which is taken from Fridtjof Nansen, the great Norwegian explorer. The idea of adventure and exploration is to push beyond the limits of the known.
For yourself or for humanity?
Well, it's grandiose to say for humanity, but I really do believe that. The history of exploration is one of opening up new places, sometimes for the unpleasant business of empire and conquest, but also for discovery and for understanding of ultimately of the universe.
But then there are the people who go to places like Mount Everest that have been well trod, but are very difficult anyway to climb, and it is a test of their own mettle, I suppose. There's that other strain of it too, where you're just trying to push yourself and trying to maybe discover your own limits.
I don't think Everest is the place where adventure or exploration is happening today. There are realms like cave diving and caving, which don't get much attention at all, where the unknown is really waiting out there to be discovered. We don't even know what the deepest cave in the world is. Hmm. That's an amazing fact when 500 people every spring stand on the top of Mount Everest.
So is there a type of person who is an adventurer, is a type of personality, do you think, or a type of, I don't know, a kind of person who is driven to do this? Are there common characteristics?
I think you have to start with a complete dissatisfaction with safe, normal life, a kind of neurotic need to get away, probably is as good a motivation as any. I certainly needed, from the first years I grew up in Boulder, Colorado, to get out and to get away and to get up into the mountains. The petty pace from day to day, as Shakespeare called it, becomes intolerable.
Hmm. You found that exploring the outdoors and pushing yourself and climbing was a way to understand what it meant to be alive, right?
Yeah. I mean, the chance of losing your life, of course, is a great wake-up call. It's pretty hard to be blasé when you're off route on a big climb and the weather's moving in, and you've got to do everything you can to survive. That's where it shades into what people think of as thrill-seeking, and it really isn't about thrill-seeking. In fact, most good adventurers dread fear and don't seek out fear. Fear is the unfortunate residue of when things go wrong. And your skill is all devoted to not overcoming fear, you can't do that, but to figuring a way out of the trap that fear presents.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with David Roberts. He's written a new book called Limits of the Known. And you, in this book, also look at how other cultures treat adventure and how they look at climbing in particular. And you found that they look at it completely, they have different goals, I should say. They look at it differently than Westerners. Can you describe what you found?
Yeah, I think I can illustrate that with the example of the Anasazi, or the ancestral Puebloans in the Southwest, who built what are commonly called the cliff dwellings, and who must have been phenomenal climbers to get to the alcoves high on these sandstone cliffs that are dead vertical. But they didn't do it for adventure. They didn't do it to test themselves or to seek new knowledge of the world. As far as we can tell, they did it to hide their corn and beans and squash and to protect their most valuable things, including pots and baskets. And climbing was a means to an end for them. And though it's tempting to wonder whether there was also a kind of aesthetic impulse, because some of these alcoves are in dizzyingly beautiful places. But we also don't want to be romantic and project our own notions of adventure onto people like that. Mm-hmm. They lived a hard life, and the survival was the primary criterion.
Well, yeah, so I wonder if this adventure seeking is something that only wealthy people with leisure time can afford to pursue.
Ah, touche. Yeah, I mean, that's a very fair critique. You know, if you were in Syria today, you wouldn't be seeking adventure. You'd be trying to stay alive. You'd be trying to hide from the bombs that Assad was dropping on the country. Yes, in a sense, adventure can be regarded as the luxury of the leisured few and the well-educated. But so can poetry and music, and that doesn't invalidate them.
Let me ask you about your diagnosis and your illness. You write about it throughout the book as, you know, obviously transformative. And as you say, you have this sense of doom. Can you talk about how that has reframed your idea of your life's passion? Because you talk about your life as being devoted to mountain climbing, that you couldn't live without it. And so now that you can't do that, how do you think about your life and mountain climbing?
Well, it's an old cliche, but certainly every single day becomes more valuable when you're constantly threatened by death and by suffering leading to death. But I've also, I think, come to appreciate relationships more than I ever did before. Many great friendships, not only with fellow climbers, but with just friends. But also, I can never say enough about how terribly supportive and vital to my continuing existence Sharon has been, my wife. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I could have done as well for her or for anyone else. It takes an exceptional person. When I get up, I think, how many more days will I have? What can I do in those days? And actually, I think the thing I'm most grateful for in terms of the cancer is that it hasn't, as far as I know, affected my thinking and my writing.
When you think of adventuring and climbing, I mean, you're in your 70s now. Is this something, the sort of, I mean, I don't want to say heedlessness, but the thought that you're immortal, I mean, you kind of think that when you're that age. Does that go hand in hand with taking the risks of being an extreme?
It sure
mountain?
Does when you're young. Graham Greene once said, when one is young, one trifles with death. I certainly did. It's not that I thought I would live forever, because after all, Ed and before him, my first climbing partner, Gabe, were killed right in front of my eyes. I didn't think I was immortal or invulnerable, but I sort of felt that if I kept tiptoeing the right side of risk, I might get away with it. And it was so glorious to be out there that it was worth the risk. In those days, I wasn't weighing anything except my own selfish needs, and that can't be the whole equation.
Well, David Roberts, I want to thank you so much for taking the time and the energy to speak with us today. And
well, thank you. I really appreciate the depth of your questions and your probing.
Thank you. And I hope you feel better.
Thanks.
And I hope things turn out okay for you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
David Roberts is the author of the new book. It's called Limits of the Known. Resident Norwegian no longer. Just plain old,
just plain old me.
Brown bag Christian Bordahl.
That's right. Well, today I reached out to listeners to ask them about their appetite for adventure. Dale Hoskins says, as a native Southern Californian, I love to go to God's promised land in Lucerne in Switzerland. So I guess he's a bit of an alpinist. And Good Citizen, however, says, if it requires special tools to not fall off or down the hill, aside from boots and a decent walking stick, I don't do it. Caroline O says the next big trip she wants to do is to Bali. She says I'd leave tonight if I had enough vacation time from work.
So I'm
you're
I'm
ready to
her.
Go to Bali?
I'm going with Caroline.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know how much you'd be risking on that adventure. But anyway, I put up a poll asking listeners to kind of place themselves on an adventure spectrum, you know, on a scale of from like extreme risk junkie to couch potato. Where do you fit in? 3% said they're extreme risk junkies. 35% say they do a lot of climbing and hiking around different places in the world, but they always stay safe. 49%, so about half, said they're into traveling and seeing new places, and that's the kind of Bali trip, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then 13% say they're mostly into the couch and the remote.
Okay. So being on the plane, not necessarily arriving.
Exactly.
What about you?
Oh, you know, I like hiking and climbing. I have a fear of heights. So, you know, like I can go to the top of Mount Whitney because it's trail, you know, but I don't do the climber's version of that going up the mountainside because I can't quite handle that. How about you?
Yeah, that sounds okay. Yeah. Oh, the Whitney, that's a lot. That's a lot.
It's a big climb, but it's fun.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.